Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and the private prison industry got behind Donald Trump during the election. Here's why.
By the way, with prisons, I think we can do a lot of privatizations and private prisons. It seems to work a lot better.
That from a spring 2016 town hall meeting on MSNBC. And no other industry profited as immediately from the Trump presidency as the private prison industry. In the week after Election Day, stocks of GEO and CoreCivic, the two biggest for-profit detention companies, shot up more than 20 and 40%. To paraphrase the New York Times, were they right to be hopeful about their industry? Do lobbyists in Washington or state capitals push the law toward mass incarceration because they make money from each additional prisoner? Let's look at private prisons and their impact in the first year after the election with Lauren Brooke Eisen, senior counsel in the Brennan Center's Justice Program and author of a brand new book, Inside Private Prisons, An American Dilemma in the Age of Mass Incarceration. Lauren Brooke, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What's the dilemma?
That's a great question. And that's the central inquiry of my new book. And the dilemma is that we have allowed the profit motive to become intertwined with corrections in America. So in the book, I trace the history of the privatization of justice, and then I look at how this industry emerged in the 1980s and early 1990s. And the industry I'm talking about is these corporations that own and operate prisons and jails across the country. They also now own immigration detention centers. So I looked at this industry. I looked at its growing share, its growing footprint in the corrections industry over the last four decades. And that's the inquiry of this new book.
And we'll go into some of that history and we'll go into the present state of things since the election of Donald Trump. But the word dilemma suggests two sides of something. So on the one hand, privatization, which might encourage mass incarceration because they have a for-profit interest in lobbying governments for those kinds of policies. But is there another side, like when Trump said in the clip from the campaign, it seems to work a lot better? Does it in some ways, or is there some other side that defines it a dilemma?
So the reason I picked dilemma for the title is that the industry is it's very divisive in this country. There are divestment movements on college campuses every day. There, the New York City Pension Fund and the Philadelphia government have recently, this year in fact, divested from the private prison industry entirely. For those who followed the election, the campaign, very closely, Hillary Clinton had to give back all of the money that the private prison industry had given her campaign. There are people on both sides of the debate, and some people feel that this is the private sector performing a government partnership. And what they're doing is they're simply housing overflow inmates from jails and prisons across the country. However, there are a lot of people in this country, including a lot of incarcerated individuals themselves and advocates, and very smart academics and researchers who feel that the industry is plagued with problems of transparency, accountability. And in my research in the book, I spoke to incarcerated individuals. I spoke to their families. I spoke to people who are behind bars in private prisons today. A lot of very smart corrections officials as well. And at the end of the day, my conclusion is that the industry is plagued by severe problems with accountability and transparency. And that's a real problem, considering prisons and immigration detention centers are pretty big black boxes as is. When we talk about the private prison industry, we just know very little about how they operate.
And I think one of the main critiques in your book is that state and federal governments do not draw up responsible contracts with private prison firms, giving them too much leeway.
Absolutely. And, you know, part of the problem here is that when the industry emerged in the 1980s, two-thirds of the states were under some sort of federal court order to reduce their prison populations. Courts were ordering states to release individuals from prisons. A lot of these prisons were at fault for very unhygienic conditions, assaults and riots, and government had to turn somewhere. And one of the big critiques that I make in the book about the industry and about American policymakers is that we let the private prison industry step in the 1980s and 1990s, and we let them build these prisons quickly and easily, and they were able to do so because they could go around government procurement laws, and they had the capital to do so. And policymakers didn't have to raise taxes, so they could be seen as tough on crime, building new prisons, and it wasn't costing taxpayers money. And this industry essentially let policymakers off the hook. They didn't have to make these tough decisions about how to safely reduce prison populations. Policymakers at the time, they weren't asking, do we have too many people behind bars? And that's a big problem. And in the book, I think that's a moment. It's a moment in mass incarceration when we could have started to safely downsize prison populations and we didn't.
Listeners, any questions for Lauren Brooke Eisen from the Brennan Center? Her new book is Inside Private Prisons, An American Dilemma in the Age of Mass Incarceration. Anybody listening who's ever been in a private prison serving time, or anybody who's ever worked in a private prison, or anyone else, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And on how they perform, if people have a kind of vague notion that private contractors might be likely to perform better than the government itself at various things, I see that you mentioned that last year, when the Obama administration announced that it would begin phasing out the use of private prisons for federal inmates, the then Deputy Attorney General, by the way, that was Sally Yates, wrote in a memo that private prisons, quote, compare poorly to public facilities. She wrote, private prisons simply do not provide the same level of correctional services, programs, and resources. They do not save substantially on costs. They do not maintain the same level of safety and security. Do you want to pick one of those and go into it a little bit?
So you're exactly right that the Obama administration tried to curb the nation's reliance on private prisons. And as soon as Attorney General Sessions came into office, he sent a one-page memo to the Bureau of Prisons reversing that Obama-era guidance. And that's pretty significant because that's really set the stage. It was a harbinger of things to come. And since that memo, we have seen the Trump administration increasingly rely on the private sector to house the immigrant detention population in this country. And that's something that a lot of people don't know about. So when we talk about private prisons, people tend to think about these state and federal prisons that are owned and operated by, you know, GEO Group and CoreCivic, the nation's two biggest private prison corporations. But we have essentially privatized immigration detention in this country. In fact, 65% of beds inside immigration detention centers are privatized. And earlier,
let me linger on that for just a second, because if people are thinking about private prisons and they don't know much about this area, they may think, well, prison, okay, this is where the rapists and the murderers are. But largely, this is where immigrants who haven't committed a crime, who are just waiting for their immigration status to be resolved, a lot of people who come into the country asking for asylum, that kind of thing, that's who's in these private prisons?
This population in these immigration detention centers are civil detainees. And I spent time in some of these facilities when I was researching the book. I spent some time in South Texas. I interviewed a lot of detainees in these detention centers. And if you walk around these facilities, they look and feel like a prison. These people are behind bars. They're not free to go. And you're absolutely right. Most of them have not been convicted of a crime. And earlier this year, the Trump administration requested more than $1.2 billion in the 2018 federal budget to expand detention capacity to more than 48,000 beds a day. And the current daily capacity ranges from about 28,000 to 38,000 beds. And the people who will reap the benefit of that are the private prison corporations.
We have calls coming in, and we'll take them in a minute, for Lauren Brooke Eisen, author of Inside Private Prisons, An American Dilemma in the Age of Mass Incarceration. Coincidentally, here's a news story that just came across about somebody that's not going to prison, and it's Bo Bergdahl. A judge has just ruled that Bergdahl should serve no prison time for endangering comrades by walking off his Afghanistan post. He will get a dishonorable discharge. He will lose his rank. He will forfeit pay. But this deserter from Afghanistan, U.S. Troop, will not go to prison. We'll continue with Lauren Eisen Brooke. Lauren Brooke Eisen, forgive me, in just a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Lauren Brooke Eisen from the Brennan Center for Justice, author now of Inside Private Prisons, An American Dilemma in the Age of Mass Incarceration. And Natalie in Bergen County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Natalie.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a huge fan of your show. You're one of my favorite WNYC programs.
Thank you so much.
I'm calling. I am a state social worker. I work in a state prison in New Jersey. I won't say which one. I've been working at the same prison now for 5 years, but I've been an employee of the state for the last year. And my comment is that, you know, I'm really excited, and really important to talk about this issue, because I think that, number one, it doesn't get discussed enough. This is an issue that affects essentially inmates, and I don't think that they really It's not always valued how important this discussion is. It's very scary, because I think that right now what I see in prison, it's already difficult to make sure that they're getting the services that they need, that they're treated fairly. And this issue of a mass incarceration, I think this is just a huge step backwards in some of the progress that we've been making. And people need to know that, you know, A lot of you can get away with a lot in terms of not giving services that they need, fair treatment, and you don't really know. I mean, unless you're a family member or an employee, somebody that knows somebody who's incarcerated or at one of these halfway houses, they really get forgotten about. So we need to be talking about this issue more, especially now that there's such a push for private prisons, and this is essentially becoming a business, and it's really unfortunate and scary.
Thank you for your call, Natalie. I appreciate it. Patrick in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hi, Patrick.
Hi, Brian. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate this topic. This is actually something that I wrote about in my ethics class regarding the privatization of prisons, and for me, what it brings to light is a major conflict of interest that our government essentially, you know, when you go to the Bureau of Prisons, their mission statement talks about rehabilitation as part of its mission. And yet we have an entire industry that's supported by our government that is incentivizing prisons. It is incentivizing the number of prisoners that are arrested. It's incentivizing the number of beds rather than incentivizing recidivism or incentivizing rehabilitation. And so to me, I'm just kind of baffled that this has not become more of a conversation, a topic, as to the major conflict of interest that this is for our government.
Laura?
I agree with you there. And this idea of perverse incentives is really at the heart of the matter. When we talk about Department of Corrections, I interviewed a lot of directors of corrections from all across the country, and every single one says, my job is to rehabilitate the people who are in my care and custody for however long they are with us. And that is at odds with this idea of profiting off of mass incarceration, because at the end of the day, these corporations need to fill their prisons. And, you know, they're very clear. If you tune into their investor calls or read their annual reports, these corporations need to have full prisons, full detention centers, in order to turn a profit. And that is at odds with the notion of rehabilitation and reentry and improving the lives of so many people who are incarcerated. And you're exactly right. And in the book, I make some recommendations for how to change these perverse incentives in the industry. And I argue that given the political realities that Donald Trump is president of the United States and this administration is very pro-privatization, while private prisons exist, how can we improve the lives of so many who are behind bars in these facilities? And one of the suggestions I make is that governments should rewrite these contracts so that these corporations are required to reduce recidivism rates. And I'm sure you're well aware that government recidivism rates are atrocious in this country, 50 to 75%. What that means is that almost three quarters of the people who leave prison today return within 3 years. And
so your proposal suggests, though, that people are going back to crime when they get out of prison because of something that happened in prison.
Well, it's very complicated why people may recidivate, but the idea is that the for-profit sector needs to innovate where government hasn't. And I think that we as a society, as long as these private prisons exist, we need to hold these corporations' feet to the fire, and we need to say, beat the government's recidivism rate. The government's doing a terrible job at rehabilitating individuals. If we're going to pay you to run these prisons, you need to beat the government's rate.
Michael and Baldwin, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, Brian. And also, Lauren, you know, good job putting out a book like this.
Thank you.
And my comments have to do with, I'll use FCI Loretto, which I was in for a couple of years, and they have a company in there called Unicor. And prisoners work for Unicor. They get no disability. They get nothing. They get paid very, very little money. And they make products for companies like Northrop Grumman, and then sell them back to the United States government. And you have other companies like Prison Blues, and there's an entire industry in all the federal, if not all, of the federal prisons where they make products for private or compete against private corporations. And you can look at year 2000 or 2001, the chief of the Bureau of Prison was also on the board of Unicor, which is a total conflict of interest. And nobody knows about this almost. And who owns the stocks? Congressmen, I was looking into this, a congressman were actually buying the stocks for Unicor. So everybody wants to make money on this deal.
Statement. Thank you very much, Michael. I appreciate it. Can congressmen do that? Is that allowed? Can they buy stock in private prisons and then pass legislation with respect to them? Do you happen to know?
So it sounds like this congressman might have had stock in one of the industries around incarceration. It doesn't sound like it was actually the private prison industry, one of these big real estate corporations. But this idea that the caller brought up about profiting off of mass incarceration is really core to the book. And I look at the prison industrial complex, which is vast and beyond these prison real estate companies that own and operate prisons. There's a company called JPay, and when I spoke to a lot of incarcerated individuals, they said it's the Apple of prisons, and they provide email services and video conferencing services to incarcerated individuals, but at a fee, and the fee is pretty hefty. So a lot of the people I spoke with said it's $10 for me to Skype video conference home with my family, and it's hard for them to come up with that money. There's really no shortage of corporations. There's Aramark, food services corporations that make money off of incarceration.
And we've done a separate segment on the show about the overcharging of prisoners for phone calls in particular. We just have 30 seconds left. What has changed in the year since Trump was elected, promising a return to federal private prisons? And then, as you say, as soon as he got in, Jeff Sessions as Attorney General issued that one page policy statement, very briefly. Has a lot changed?
We're starting to see things change. We've already seen that GEO Group stock has increased 63%, and CoreCivics has risen over 80% since Trump was elected. And we're starting to see a lot of early requests for proposals, requests for information from the Trump administration for new immigration detention centers, especially in the interior of the country. And that's a boon for these industries.
And we have to leave it there with Lauren Brooke Eisen, author of Inside Private Prisons, An American Dilemma in the Age of Mass Incarceration. If you want to see her talk more about this in person, she has three events coming up next week. Tuesday at 6 o'clock at the Brennan Center event hosted at the Torch Club. That's Tuesday. Then Wednesday, 7:30 p.m. at the Strand Bookstore. And next Thursday, 7 o'clock at Book Culture. For more information, you can go to our page, wnyc.org, and click on Brian Lehrer Show. Lauren, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.